Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to Success Story. I'm your host, Scott D. Clary. The Success Story podcast is part of the HubSpot podcast network, which has other amazing podcasts like Business Made Simple, hosted by Donald Miller. Business Made Simple takes the mystery out of growing your business, so make sure you tune in wherever you get your podcast. Today, my guest is Ronald Diamond, longtime investor and entrepreneur. Ron Diamond is the founder and chairman of Diamond Wealth. He represents over 100 family offices ranging in size from $250 million to $30 billion. Diamond Wealth invests in private markets, including private equity, venture capital, and real estate. In addition, Diamond Wealth has divisions that focus on philanthropy, wealth transfer, investment banking, social impact, and governance. Earlier in his career, he founded Pinnacle Capital, a $250 million hedge fund that outperformed the S&P index 10 out of 10 years before ultimately selling his company to an international investment firm. Previously, Diamond served as senior managing director at Bear Stearns, and he began his career as an analyst at Drexel Burnham Lambert. He serves on the advisory board of 10 privately held companies and acts as chairman for four of them. He is also chair of two Tiger 21 chapters in Chicago and chairs a newly created family office group for Tiger 21. He is the past chairman of the advisory board for the Disruptive Technology and Digital Cities program at Stanford University and taught classes in the entrepreneurship program at Stanford.
I was 24 years old. I was sitting in a room with a group of extraordinarily successful people at Drexel Burnham. Drexel Burnham at the time was the most profitable firm on Wall Street. Fred Joseph, the CEO, came into the meeting. I was a trainee at the time, and he announced that Drexel Burnham was going bankrupt. So I'm literally in the room with the 10 kids from my training program. We're all 24 years old. It didn't impact us much because we didn't have stock options and we lost a good job. But I'm literally watching people in their 60s and 70s, and many of them were openly weeping. And on Wall Street, certainly in the 70s, in the 80s and 90s, that typically didn't happen. Many of the people lost most or all of their money at Drexel. It was a surreal moment, but my takeaway from that was I would always be loyal to people, but not to a company. Because if this can happen to Drexel, this could happen to anybody. So as a result of that, my plan initially was to stay at Drexel for 50 years and hopefully run one of the divisions. That fell apart 2 years later. So I moved back to Chicago. My father was sick, so I did move back to Chicago, and I ended up starting a hedge fund. But that was not what the initial plan was.
And walk me through starting a hedge fund, because anybody that's listening, that's a very daunting task. So you just, yeah.
It sounds more daunting than it really is. As long as you have a group of investors that have confidence in you to give a small dollar amount of money, you don't have to open a hedge fund with a huge dollar amount, and we didn't. I had several people that I've known most of my life, and I've done fairly well in school, and they had confidence in me to give me a small dollar amount of money to see how I would do, and if I did well, they'd maybe give me more. That's kind of how we got started. It ultimately grew, and we had very good performance, but to get started, I called an attorney, we structured the documents, I found some investors, we had enough money to get started, and then we got started. I didn't know what I was doing. I mean, literally, you just do it as is. In retrospect, I kind of laugh at kind of how that whole period of my life, but I didn't know enough to know that you shouldn't start a hedge fund right away. But I did, and it worked out fine.
I feel like that's a good entrepreneurial lesson. I think sometimes the people that are successful are the people that don't know any better, and they just do it. How did, as somebody who built a fund, curious about how you decided investment thesis, how you decided like what strategy you would take. Like, it was obviously learning as you go. But if anybody who's listening to this, which is probably a more complex topic, a lot of the people that listen to this podcast are more entrepreneurs, but this is a business at the end of the day. If anybody ever wanted to emulate you, what are some tips, advice for somebody else starting a fund?
Well, don't emulate me as a person. But as far as the fund is concerned, we were pretty good stock pickers. We had some proprietary models. We never had huge returns. We never had 40, 50, 60% returns like a lot of the hedge funds. And remember also, when I had the hedge fund, this was very early in the hedge fund era. I mean, back then it was in the 90s, from 1990 to 2000. So people used to think you can make money in an up market or a down market. That's the term hedge fund. That wasn't the case. You're either good at one or good at the other. And we were pretty good at picking stocks. We also had a lot of luck because in the 90s, you had a bull market. And so it wasn't that challenging. If I did my exact same strategy from 2005 through 2010, I would have gotten clobbered. So we were pretty good at what we did, but there's an element of luck and timing, which is critical. And I think that's true with any entrepreneur, and certainly true with me.
When you build this out, what's the exit plan? So following your career a little bit longer, you built this out to what level, what assets under management, how long did you do this for, and then what did you do after?
So we ran it, first of all, I didn't have an exit, it's not like a company where I had an exit plan or an exit strategy where I was going to hold it for 5 years and then sell it. I started in 1990 and I sold it in 2000. So I ran it for about 10 years. We ran about $250 million. And again, we never had huge returns. What we did have, though, was consistency, and we beat the S&P 10 out of 10 years. Our clients were happy because if they're up, market's up 7, we're up 8.5, they're fine. In the 90s, they didn't call them family offices. They called them rich people, and now they call them family offices. So that's kind of how I got into the business of family offices. So I had all these rich people who are now called family offices, and we basically invested. We picked stocks that we thought would go up. We were pretty good at it. We had big tailwind behind us. And in 2000, I felt the market was overvalued. I sold the company to a market neutral fund. I brought 100% of the assets over, stayed on for 6 months, and then I just took a year off. Started doing some traveling, got into yoga, meditation, and then after about 8 months, I just couldn't do it anymore. So I needed to get back to work.
And then, okay, so then when... Obviously, that's an interesting exit. You have a liquidity event. Now, what's next for you when you want to build something from scratch again? You could have started another fund. Obviously, you've done that once before. But now you operate in a slightly different way. So explain your thought process as to, after a liquidity event from selling a fund, where do you position your time? You could build a company. You could build another fund. What do you do now?
Well, it was... My plan was to start a private equity firm. And while I was planning that, I wanted to invest. So I like to invest in the private markets, which is private equity, venture capital, real estate, credit, things like that. And so basically what I did was I would just make small investments in those different asset classes. And I also like to do the direct deals rather than invest in the funds. So I would do that. And then my thought process was, I want it to be, typically, if there's a very attractive deal, private equity, venture capital, real estate deal, typically whoever owns that deal, they're going to usually call their number one or their wealthiest clients first and then kind of go down the list. I didn't have enough capital to be the first call, but cumulatively I did. So basically what I did is I went to the family offices that were with me before when they were just rich people, and now they're family offices. And I said, I'll put a small dollar amount in. I might put $1 or $2 million into a direct deal. You could put $40, $50, $60 million cumulatively. We work with about 100 family offices, and these are families ranging anywhere between $250 million up to $30 billion. So they put the big chunk of the money in there. And as a result of that, I now have enough money to be the first call. So I call it first call alpha. We don't charge anything. But I'm not doing it for self-list purposes. I do it selfishly because without their money, I wouldn't be the first call and get the great deals. And it also does benefit them because I am doing some diligence and there's some value add that I'm doing acting as the funnel. So that's kind of what we do right now.
And actually, now that I think about this structure, can you actually help me understand like why you didn't just start that private equity firm? Because then all these rich people, family offices, they could have been LPs.
True. I can't give you a real reason for it. It just I started investing, and then my thought process was as I started investing and before I'm starting the private equity firm, I realized that what I've done by doing what I call first call alpha, I love doing it. So I was pretty good at it and I love doing it. So if you're pretty good at something and you love doing it, that's really what you should do. So that's
Good
kind of how it
advice.
happened. So it wasn't like a grand scheme that I had a great idea. It was serendipitous.
And okay, so then what does the business look like now? So just describe like who you work with, what the actual is, because now it's matured a little bit.
Right. So I'm hesitant to call it a business. So basically, what we
Sure.
do, we invest, I invest my own capital, which is a finite amount of capital. And we work with about 100 family offices. These are families anywhere between $250 million to $30 billion. And we look for the private market, private deals, private equity, venture capital, real estate, credit. I kind of act as a funnel. So if I see a private equity deal, I know 17 families that love that type of private equity. If it's a cannabis deal, there might be six people. If it's a multifamily real estate deal, there might be 70 people. So I kind of know who likes what. When I see a deal, I will look at it, diligence it, invest it myself, and then I'll go to my network. And if they want to invest in it, terrific. And if they don't, that's fine. But I know what everybody likes. So I'm not going to go, if somebody doesn't invest in early stage venture, I'm not going to show them an early stage venture deal. If somebody doesn't invest in multifamily realty, I'm not going to show them that. So I kind of know who likes what, and I show them the deal. And as a result of that, we'll structure an SPV, which is and a special purpose vehicle, and come in and just invest, and we typically can get better economics because if you come in investing $50 million, you can more become part of the general partner and you could dictate terms a lot better than I could if I can only put in $1 or $2 million. So that's really why we're doing it, why I'm doing it.
And so now you've worked with all these rich people turned family offices, and I know that's like the majority of the focus of your work. So walk me through, I guess, even the history of the family office, because I think people understand venture capital, they're everywhere. People understand even what like private equity means. They've heard the term hedge fund before, but family office is like it's everywhere, but nobody quite understands what it means.
Including people in the industry. So in the US, it probably started at Rockefeller, maybe 1875. In Europe, it started way before then. You could go back to Akbar the Great. Go back hundreds and hundreds of years. But basically, when you hear the word family office, most of the family office, 68% of family offices that are in existence today started since 2000. And half of those started since the crash of 2008. So let's kind of bucket this is the family offices really as people know it today, most of which started after 2000. So this is a relatively new phenomenon. The interesting thing about the industry and the fascinating thing about the industry is I believe that as private equity and venture capital disrupted the public markets in the early 90s because it was a superior model. If you have a company and you've got to report to a guy like me or other analysts every 90 days, it's hard to run a company long term. So the reason private equity and venture capital exploded was because it was a better model. And it was a better model because 2% I'm only paying for the overhead, and 20% I only make money if you make money. So that model made more sense in general than the public markets where you had to report every 90 days. The market exploded. What happened is, and again, I'm generalizing because I do have money in private equity funds and venture capital funds, but in general, they bastardized the business and it became an AUM game. And what should be a $500 million fund became a $5 billion fund. And I'll give you like a specific example, which I think is a microcosm of what's happened to the industry and why family offices are starting to disrupt private equity and venture capital. A friend of mine rolled up a logistics, did a roll up of logistics companies, and he went to a placement agent in New York and he needed about $150 million. Placement agent, based on his track record, was actually able to get him close to $500 million. My friend said, terrific, I just need 150 and let's get started. The placement agent literally came to his house in New York and wrote down on paper, 2% of 500 million equals X, 2% of 150 million equals Y, what am I missing? And my friend was a bit incredulous. He goes, here's what you're missing. I won't have another fund if I do what you want me to do, because I can't deploy 500 million. I can deploy 150 million very efficiently, but the other $350 million, I can't deploy that well. Now, I'm smart enough to know that 2% to $500 million, I'll make more money today, but it's not going to help the performance of the fund. So again, I'm generalizing, but this is a microcosm. So these private equity firms and venture capital firms have become massive, and it's become an AUM game, and it's become an inherent conflict of interest in many instances. Family offices, the biggest advantage they have is something called patient capital. Patient capital is they don't have to sell. So if you look at it from a macro standpoint, the private equity and the venture capital firms, which I believe in general are a better model than the public companies, they're compensated to turn companies over every 3 to 5 years, irrespective of how the company, where the company's at. That's how they're compensated. That's not necessarily the best way to create long-term wealth. So if you look at what happens in a lot of the markets, it's typically private equity firm A sells to private equity firm B, and they do well, and sell to private equity firm C until somebody doesn't do well, right? So there's so much money out there. Family offices, so if you look at a company that's been bought and sold 3 times over a 20-year period, and then you look at a family office who bought it once, held it for those 20 years, didn't have to pay the taxes, didn't have to pay the transaction costs, didn't have to figure out ways to redeploy the money, it's a much better deal, right? So patient capital is by far the biggest advantage that family offices have over private equity and venture capital. Now, having said that, they're not going to replace private equity and venture capital, because private equity and venture capital are huge industries and they're going to continue to grow. All I am saying is that they're going to start to disrupt them, because there is a better alignment of interest. So let's say you're an entrepreneur and you've got a great idea for a widget company.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Just a quick question. Have you ever had one of those oh no moments when you realize that you accidentally deleted a huge file? Or worse, your whole computer dies. I know I have. It's happened to me a lot, but don't sweat it. The sponsor of today's episode, Backblaze, they have your back. It is unlimited backups for all your Macs, your PCs, or even your whole company, and it's really affordable, under $100 a year. If you're running a business, they take the stress out of protecting everyone's data. If you need more bells and whistles for compliance, so on and so forth, they have enterprise options too. Honestly, losing data sucks, but Backblaze makes getting it back easy. They have restored billions of files. They offer tons of restore options, including rapid recovery in an event of data loss or ransomware. And you can access your backed up data from everywhere and anywhere in the world using their web app, iOS, or Android apps. It's been recommended by the New York Times, Inc., Macworld, PC World, LifeWire, Wired, Tom's Guide, 9to5Mac, and tons more. And best, you can try it fully featured with no risk at backblaze.com/story. They set up that link for all Success Story podcast listeners. That is a no-risk free trial at backblaze.com/story. Seriously, back up your stuff. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success. Today's show is brought to you by 1Password. Now listen, we all have that one friend who's constantly forgetting passwords and needing help to get into their accounts. I have a solution. It's called 1Password. 1Password is the award-winning password manager trusted by millions of users and companies like IBM and Slack to keep logins, credit cards, and other private info safe in an encrypted vault that only you can access. No more sticky notes with passwords or using the same password everywhere. I've been using 1Password for a year now, and I can't recommend it enough. It saves me time from having to reset passwords and gives me peace of mind knowing my info is secure. With convenient features like automatic password generation and login autofill, 1Password takes the hassle out of passwords. You can use it on all your devices, iOS, Android, Mac, PC. Everything syncs seamlessly. And with top-notch security audits and encryption, your data stays private. So do yourself a favor and check out 1Password today. Go to 1Password.com/Clary and get a 2-week free trial. Let 1Password remember all of your logins for you so you can remember what really matters. That's 1Password.com/Clary. For 2 weeks free. Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
What used to happen is you go to Sequoia or NEA or one of these big venture capital firms, and you're like, terrific, I'm funded by this huge venture capital firm, and you're set. Here's the problem. If you're that entrepreneur, you're one of 20 portfolio companies, right, within the fund. Let's assume it takes 3 years or so to make traction, and then you think your company's about to hockey stick up. You're 1/20th of the fund. They might decide, even though they might believe you're about to hockey stick up, that they want to bring in somebody else, so they could sell you even though it might not be in your best interest. So you don't really control that, right? The venture capital firm does. And remember, they're trying to turn money over every 3 to 5 years. It's a better model for the entrepreneurs to partner with the family office. The problem is that the family office market in general, the world that I'm in, is very fragmented, very inefficient, and very siloed in general. That's starting to change, and you're starting to see family offices become more institutionalized. So the statistics are 25% of family offices make it to the second generation, 10% make it to the third, and 5% make it to the fourth. So the model doesn't work. And why is that? Well, part of the reason, a large part of the reason, is because if you look at who has these family offices, it's the guy who sold Beanie Babies. It's the guy who started 5-Hour Energy or Guess Jeans or Giorgio Perfume or a chain of gas stations. They have a liquidity event for $1 billion. It's a totally different skill set to sell Beanie Babies or Guess Jeans, which, you know, I couldn't do, than to take $1 billion, grow it to two, not spoil the kids, do some estate planning, wealth transfer, and grow the asset base. So you've got huge amounts of capital in general, very inefficient hands. The market today in family offices, $10 trillion in capital in family offices. There's currently $4.5 trillion in capital in the hedge fund space worldwide combined.
That's wild.
In the next 15 years, you've got $65 trillion that's going to transfer from the baby boomers to the next gen. This will be the largest transfer of wealth in history. As a result of that, family offices in the next 10 years will be larger than private equity and venture capital combined. So the market is massive. The problem is that it's a new industry, it's inefficient, it's fragmented and siloed. So what's starting to happen, and I think we're in the third inning, maybe the top of the fourth, but we're still early in this, that family offices are starting to become more sophisticated. So you look at what the Pritzkers did. So Paul Carbone is a friend who runs the Pritzker family office. They've institutionalized it. You look at what Michael Dell's family office
has done. Can you explain what that means? What does it mean when you say they institutionalized?
So in other words, basically, you've got a family office now that has a huge pool of money, but they run it more like an institution. So when you hear the term family office, everyone thinks of something different. A lot of people might think of Michael Dell or Michael Bloomberg, these billionaires, or Ross Perot, who made a lot of money. Most family offices today are not like that. Most of them are much smaller, and most of them are not really run efficiently. And they, because the founder made a tremendous amount of money, he or she made a lot of money in whatever business they were in, it doesn't necessarily translate to I can now invest and do that well. So you've got a lot of people right now with a tremendous amount of money that are, at least in my opinion, in over their heads. In order for it to make economic sense to start a family office, and again, I'm not right, this is just my opinion, you need a bare bones minimum of $250 million in order for it to make economic sense if you're going to invest in the private markets, private equity, venture capital, credit, real estate. Some people would argue $500 million. There's a ton of family offices that are a lot less. Those families that are much less than that, they're much better off going to what's called a multifamily office. So I'll touch on what a multifamily office is and how that's grown. You started 50, 60, 70 years ago, you had the wirehouses. Now, the problem with the wirehouses in general is they're technically not even fiduciaries, which is mind-boggling if you think about it. As a result of that, over the last 10 to 15 years, something called RIAs, which are registered investment advisors, came to fruition. They're fiduciaries, which means they have to do what's in the client's best interest, right? So the growth in RIAs has exploded over the past 10 to 15 years. On top of that, you have the multifamily offices. All that is, it's an RIA that looks at things holistically. So they're not just trying to create alpha. They're also looking at estate planning, wealth transfer, philanthropy, next gen, succession. That's all that is. So you've got the wirehouses is model one. The next iteration is the RIAs, which was a better model because they're fiduciaries. And then on top of that, which is the best model, is the multifamily offices. There's a lot of people who are running single family offices that, in my opinion, would be better off in multifamily offices without the proper amount of capital and without the amount of talent to do that. You're better off with a multifamily office. Now, having said that, let's assume you're the Pritzkers or the Crowns or the Dells or the Bloombergs of the world. Yeah, you can institutionalize it. So they pay these people, and you have to remember, you have to pay for talent. So one of the problems with family offices, and again, I'm generalizing, but if a family office pays somebody $500,000, in general, many of them look at that as a cost. In other words, that cost me $500,000. If a private equity or venture capital, if Apollo or Carlyle comes in and pays somebody $500,000, they look at that person as a potential $10, $20 million profit center. So it's nuanced. It's not a cost, it's a profit center. But until the family offices get to the point where they start looking at it as a potential profit center and not as a cost, like some of the family offices are, they're not going to be able to get there. That's slowly starting to change. So what's fascinating about the industry right now is as private equity and venture capital, as I said, disrupted the public markets in the early 80s and 90s, you're starting to see family offices compete and disrupt private equity and venture capital based on the fact that they've got patient capital and they've got money that can just compound, and that's what they're looking to do.
And this is how the family office environment is now evolving. And this is what you're actively seeing now. So we're living through this renaissance of.
This is happening real time. And again, I will tell you that a lot of the family offices, post-crash, pre-COVID, the thing with family offices is they wanted to do direct investments. And they wanted to do direct investments because they didn't want to pay 220. They didn't want to pay the fees. The problem, the good thing and the bad news, the problem is everything from post-crash, pre-COVID, everything went up. So if you're investing in private equity, venture capital, real estate, Bitcoin, the stock market, you probably made money. So these people who did these investments and then they didn't pay fees, it's not that hard. As we head into a recession, and I think we are starting to head into a recession, people will realize there's a skill set to what these private equity and venture capital and real estate guys do. And I think a lot of people are in over their skis. So I think how this is going to play out, a lot of these people who did the direct deals previously are going to come back to more of the experts, won't mind paying the fees because they realize that they're worth it. And the family offices that have built out institutions like the Pritzkers, like the Dells, like the Crown family, they can compete directly. But you're going to see a backlash, and more of the family offices, at least in my opinion, are going to use consultants or use outside people rather than doing everything internally unless they've got the right infrastructure. So it's a th this is all happening real time right now.
Well, I'm curious about going through a liquidity event that large, and I know that you chair I think one of the offices for Tiger 21, and I've spoken to Tim from Tiger 21, and I understand that that's not an advisory for like a private equity firm, but it offers guidance as to what to do holistically. Very, very similar to what you're saying, all the multifamily office services provide it. It's a
Right.
holistic view of what to do after a major liquidity event, right? And I think that, I mean, you see this firsthand, people going from operator to capital allocator at like en masse, like with huge amounts of capital, have no idea really what they're doing. And also, maybe just, speak through some of the things that they have to think about outside of just capital allocation that are the realities for them. I mean, like, you've just mentioned these numbers, these very devastating numbers about how quickly, generational wealth is lost. So why does that happen?
In my opinion, a lot of it has to do with ego. It has to do with the ego of the founder, of the person who had the liquidity event. You have a liquidity event, you could do anything you want with your money. And I make no judgments. You do whatever you want. But I think a lot of times people think that because they're good at one thing, that means they're going to be good at everything. And it's a different skill set to sell Beanie Babies than to take $1 billion and grow it to two. So I think the problem with many people is because they've had such success with so much money at such a young age. And remember, this is not generational. Back when the Rockefeller started, it took 10, 20, 30 years to create generational wealth. You can create an app today in a year and create huge amounts of generational wealth. So it's happening so quickly. And that's why the speed is happening so quickly. So family offices right now, you could talk to 10 experts and what's a family office, how much money do you need for a family office, why do you create a family office? You're going to get totally different answers. I gave a keynote at Stanford 5 years ago. I had $5 billion families, and I asked each one of them, what is a family office and why did you create it? And there were five completely different answers. And nobody was right and nobody was wrong. It's just that's where we are in the industry. So I think that the fascinating thing for me is that in 1986, when I was a senior in college, My dad, who was a brilliant banker, wanted me to meet this guy who was also a banker. And he said, there's an industry called private equity, and I'd like you to, you should look at it because I think it's going to be big. Well, when you're 20 years old, you're smarter than your dad. And so I said, Dad, I already got a job at Drexel Burnham. I'm not going to listen to you, who you want me to talk to. And I went to Drexel. Well, fast forward 2 years, Drexel goes bankrupt. And the person he wanted to introduce me to was John Canning, who started Madison Dearborn, which became one of the largest private equity firms. And the industry was called private equity. So to me, when I look at that point, and obviously in retrospect, I would have done things differently. But I do think that we're at that inflection point right now where, just like private equity and venture capital firms disrupted the public markets, I do see family offices starting to do it. So I do think we're at a tipping point right now. And I think family offices can make a huge amount of difference, not just in creating alpha, but equally, if not more important, in a lot of the philanthropic endeavors they can engage in.
And obviously, to engage in philanthropic endeavors, they have to be successful and maintain that success. But I'm curious about, this seems like there's this problem with the family office industry, for lack of a better term. It's that they're so fragmented. You mentioned this before. So how do you actively fix that? Because there's no group or organization that supports, you know, the collective body of family offices. So what drives them in the right direction?
Well, and the other issue is, you know, there's a lot of family office, first of all, every bank, every law firm, every accounting firm, they're trying to get into the family office world. This is where all the money is. It makes sense. And you've got all these family office conferences. The problem with a lot of the conferences where these family offices are supposed to learn to invest is many of them have become a pay-to-play game. So if you're speaking, it's not that you're necessarily an expert in real estate. It's that you spent $25,000 to be able to speak. And you're really just selling your fund. It's an inherent conflict of interest, in my opinion. So I think that you have to look at from the standpoint of what is in the best interest of family offices, and where are you getting your deal flow from, and what are people's agendas. So everybody has an agenda, and that's fine. But I just think that family offices in general, the first, second, and third thing they want to know before they're going to work with anybody is, can I trust this person? And then the fourth thing is, what's your 1-3-5-year track record? What's your biggest drawdown? That's flipped when you look at it from an institution. So trust is the main component of why family offices will work with somebody.
I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, HubSpot. It's time to get out of your spreadsheets. With HubSpot CRM, you get real-time data at your fingertips so your teams stay in sync across the customer journey. You track your contacts and customers, send personalized emails in bulk, and get the context you need to create amazing experiences for your teams and customers at scale, all from one powerful platform. It's why more than 150,000 companies already use HubSpot CRM to run their business better. Plus, HubSpot's user-friendly interface sets you up for success from day one, so you can spend less time managing software and more time on what matters, your customers. There's no better time to get organized. Learn how HubSpot can help your business grow better and get a special offer of 20% off on eligible plans at HubSpot.com/successpod. And so when you work with, you deal with this industry quite a bit, what are the biggest misconceptions about family offices that you've seen?
There are so many misconceptions. How much money you need to have a family office? What's the point of a family office? I mean, a lot of these people, and again, I make no judgment. If you make the money, you could do whatever you want with it. But many people would be better off just finding a philanthropy that they like and outsourcing a lot of what they're doing. It's a full-time job. If you're going to do it right, it's a business. And many of the family offices don't take it as seriously as they did their business. If they did, then they would realize it's a full-time job. And if they did that, I think it would become more efficient. I think that's starting to happen. But the beauty to me of where we are in the world from an economic standpoint is this is changing real time right now. So the family offices, they're not there today. The smart people want to find the rich people, and the rich people want to find the smart people, but the smart people don't know how to find the rich people, and the rich people hide behind a veil and want to be secret. So how are they going to find the smart people? This is starting to change, and I think it's going to happen over the next 3 to 5 years. It's not going to like click and all of a sudden it's going to happen, But I think it's going to gradually change, and people will start realizing the value of working with the family office. A lot of people who are in real estate, a lot of people who are in private, who have deals, independent sponsors, they would prefer to work with a family office rather than a private equity or venture capital firm. The problem is, how do you find them? So one of the things that I'm trying to help with in the industry, and it's a massive task, is how do you connect the rich people and the smart people? Because once they're connected and they know what everybody wants, and everybody says this is kind of what I'm looking for, it will be a much smoother market and it'll be a much more efficient market.
I was okay, so we've spoken through significant amount of info on family offices. I'm curious if you want to take this in a couple different directions, because there's other things that you do for these families. I mean, you literally invest in them. So I'm curious if you want to go into how you source and look at deals and what your thesis is for what is good and what is bad and what you put in front of families. We can do that. Or I was, we can also go into wealth transfer. I think that's super interesting because you hear all the time about why are the rich not paying enough tax and what's going on with that? Well, I mean, there's strategies as well to help you avoid tax that maybe the average person doesn't know that much about. So whatever you feel like you want to go into, which is the most relevant, but they're both really interesting topics. So
No, they are. And also philanthropy, which is huge, and that's been a big
I don't even
component.
know what questions to ask about philanthropy outside of I'm assuming it's a focus. I mean, I'm not at that level of wealth yet where I have to worry about philanthropy. So
Well, look, so kind of my North Star is, so my dad passed away from prostate cancer at 57. My first boss was Michael Milken. Michael Milken developed prostate cancer. What Michael Milken did is, rather than throw $100 million at the American Cancer Society, he built it like a venture capital fund, right? So he put 250,000 into this crazy idea, 500 here, 2 million here. But because of him, you and I and all the male listeners will die with, but not of, prostate cancer. You look at what Bill Gates did for vaccines. I would argue he did more than the US government. My point being that if you can't run a philanthropy or family or a charity exactly like a business, but you could run it more business-like. So
I
kind of
understand.
my North Star is, you take these really innovative entrepreneurs who've done extremely well, and you apply that more towards philanthropy, and I think that's going to solve some of the big world problems. So I just did a podcast with David Rubenstein the other day. He owns the Magna Carta. He owns, I mean, he helped rebuild the Jefferson Memorial. He's done, or the Lincoln Memorial. He's done so much for philanthropy right now. And so I think there's a lot of good that can happen out of that.
So
And
you're
I think
saying,
you're starting to see that.
no, I was going to say, so it's interesting. So you think that some of the future of philanthropy, and it's not, this is not to generalize it, this has to be all of philanthropy, but it's, again, it's more doing direct investment into causes that you can actually see
I
fixing
think that,
something or.
yeah, I think that if you look at Milken, or you look at Gates, or you look at what Bloomberg's done, you can take these business minds and you again and apply it more toward to solve some of these real world problems. I don't think it's going to come from the government, and I don't think it's going to come from the corporate sector. I think it's going to come from these entrepreneurs who can make a difference. So I think for me, philanthropy is the most important aspect of family office, because at the end of the day, you can only, the pharaohs tried to bury themselves with money, and that didn't really turn out to be a great idea. What else you can't take it with you. So giving it away and doing it in a way that are important to you is something that's really, really relevant. So we do a lot of work with family offices, figuring out ways to, and prostate cancer is near and dear to my heart because my father passed away from it.
No, I think that's a smart way to look at philanthropy because I think like the way that I default to looking at it is the way that I think most people do. They just how do we put money into an organization or a government or something that's already set up? And that's not the only way to truly do
Oh,
philanthropy.
and also, what's the first, if somebody has a philanthropy, the first question people ask is, what's the overhead? It's not a good question. You don't go to Apple or Microsoft and say, what's your overhead? It's irrelevant what your overhead is. It's what's, you could have a lemonade stand that the overhead's 1%, but you're going to only create $5. So I just think you have to start asking the right questions and looking at it from a big picture standpoint.
Can we teach over some of the wealth transfer strategies that some of these individuals use? I think that'd be very valuable. So, If somebody doesn't, you know, doesn't have the advisory of a billion-dollar family office, but I'm sure some of the strategies can still be leveraged. So when you have money and you're trying to pass it on to your children, your kids, what are the strategies that you can look into and use?
Well, when I ran my hedge fund, I remember I think I was like 31 years old, and I was in a it was a billionaire's office, and he had his estate planning attorney in the meeting, and he had no idea what he was the estate planning attorney had no idea what he was talking about from the business from the finance standpoint. And when the meeting ended, I asked my prospective client who ultimately became a client, I'm like, why was he there? I did it respectfully. And he kind of put his hand on my arm, and he's like, "You'll understand one day." He goes, "The goal is not to become a billionaire. The goal is to be worth zero, but control as much as you can." And all these trust and estate planning attorneys, they're just getting stuff outside of people's estates. And that was sort of like an aha moment for me when I realized it. So what these trust and estate planning attorneys do, and a lot of the wealthy people, the family offices are closer with their trust and estate planning attorneys than they are their financial advisors, because the goal again is not to be a billionaire, it's to be worth as little as possible, but control as much as you can. That's wealth transfer. It's a very tricky issue because you don't want to give the kids too much money, right? So that's a problem unto itself. But you want to bulletproof yourself for litigation. You want to make sure that you have the ability to get things out of your estate, but you still can control it. And that's all these trusted estate planning is do.
And that's really it. So if you start a trust and you start to transfer your assets into that, then you can become like a managing director of that trust, and that does mitigate some tax responsibility, correct?
Yeah, a lot if you look at anybody, any family office or anybody who's worth, a lot of money, they've got an estate planning attorney in place, and they've got trust set up, and they've got stuff outside of their name. It might be in their children's name, it might be, but they structure it where they're bulletproof from a litigation standpoint, and they maximize the benefits they could use within the law of what you can do to
Of
transfer
course,
wealth.
yeah. No, I think that's the one thing that's very frustrating is that the average person, like they pay such a significant amount of tax in everything they do, and it's usually because they don't have access to strategies that can mitigate tax, and that's really it. Like very legal strategies.
Look, the tax code's absurdly unfair. I mean, it is what it is. If you look at the people who've made the most in private equity, hedge funds, I mean, you're paying, your carried interest. I mean, a lot of that is tax is you're benefiting from the tax system. Real estate, 1031 exchanges, you're benefiting from that. So a lot of the people who've made their money has to do, whether it's real estate, private equity, hedge funds, it is utilizing the tax code and being able to benefit from that.
Yeah, no, it's just smart to think that outside the box and just speak to people because these strategies are not mutually exclusive to wealthy individuals. That's the thing. Like they can be used by anyone. And then I guess the other question, is there any other, I guess, before we pivot into like deals that you look at, is there any other like strategies or tips that you pick up from dealing with these ultra high net worth wealthy individuals that would be just good that could be utilized by somebody who's obviously in a lower income bracket?
Yeah, I mean, I pick up things every day from them, and I think the most important thing I think I do is I try to I'm good at it. I'm not great. I'm getting better. Listening is a skill set that people in general aren't really good at. Just listen to people, and the people who've done quite well, rather than talk so much, just listen to how they did it, what they did, what their strategy was. I think listening to people who've been successful for anybody, what techniques they've used, what strategies they've used, what their MO is. I think the ability to listen is a skill set that most people are not really good at, and they're looking to think about the response to an answer before they actually fully listen to the full question.
Do you notice that that's something that is particularly like a particular skill set that people that are ultra successful, they have that in spades? Like the ability to actively listen, to sort of take a second seat in the conversation to make sure they get 100% of that information?
Well, A, you're very good at that. B, my dad told me that he was a banker, and he said you could always tell the lawyers and the entrepreneurs, because you'd go to a meeting with 10, 12 people, and the lawyers would come in, and in general, they would try to show the people that they're the smartest guys in the room, however that is. The entrepreneur, their agenda, they want to find the smartest guy in the room. All I try to do, all I've done, is just surround myself with people that are smarter than me in various areas that I trust implicitly and delegate. And if you do that, I think it's very hard not to succeed.
Agreed. No, that's very smart. Okay. And then last thing that I want to go into just very briefly, you get access to some of these incredible deals, but then you put these deals in front of your network who trust you implicitly to basically make sure that these are good deals. So when you look at some of these deals, what are you looking for? Because that's it's a lot of responsibility too.
Right. But again, they also vet the deals too, right?
Of course.
So they've got another level of diligence. And a lot of the deals we get might come from the family offices that we work with, where they see a deal, it's just too small for them, right? So a $20 million deal might be too small for them. They love the deal. They've vetted it. It's a terrific deal, risk-reward, but it doesn't make sense. It's like an individual investing $50. It doesn't make sense to do the diligence. So a lot of the deals we get are from the large family offices who see really attractive deals. It's just too small for them. It's not too small for me.
But still, I mean, so that aside, there must be some things that you do look for in deals, like some strategies. So.
We do. A lot of it is related. I would say most of the families that I work with, it's all a relationship business. And with the right relationships, I think that you'll see people will know who you are and what kind of deals you're looking for. I think that makes a big difference. And I think that people also want to work with people that they like, and they want to work with people that they trust. And, you know, there was a person, you know, I'm a big believer in just giving. At the end of the day, I can't tell you how or why, but the more you give, the more you get. It just happens. I can't tell you why rationally, but I know it's true. There was a guy in New York, and I'm always introducing people to other people. And I would say 10 to 15 times a day, I will start an email. I'd like to provide a mutually beneficial introduction. I don't have an agenda. There's no benefit to me. I just think that this person should know this person because they could each benefit themselves. That's how you have to look at it. Well, when I was in New York, I was at a family office conference, and there was a guy who was trying to raise money for early stage venture fund. And we're talking at a cocktail party. I'm like, oh, you should talk to this person. Just one thing led to another. And after he talked to the guy from the venture capital, he's like, why did you introduce me to that person? I'm like, well, what do you mean? He's like, he doesn't invest in, I'm like, I'm not, my goal at this party is not just to find people for you to invest in, right? I just thought he was a nice person and you're a good person. It would be good to meet. Now, fast forward, I've never given that person a recommendation. So I think the issue is we live in a society right now where we want to get, and we want to get instantly. And I think as you get a little, and I was much more myopic when I was younger, I think what you realize is the more you give, the more you do get. And I think that's a really important lesson that I've learned a lot from a lot of the family offices I listen to, just because I listen to them.
I'm curious, when you deal with people that are just starting out, do you see that one of the biggest detriments is their lack of patience? Because that's what it seems like that one particular individual is, just like the lack of, and actually patience has been a theme through this whole conversation, to be honest. It's like, what disrupts impatient capital? What's patient capital? What did you do well during your career? Well, you were patient with the relationships you built, and you gave and you gave and you gave, and you expected nothing in return. And then eventually.
Well, again, I was much more myopic when I was younger. So I didn't look at the world through the same lens. As you get older, hopefully you evolve and mature and look at the world through a little bit of a different lens. But I just think that you have to be able to look at things from a perspective of, you know, what's going to benefit somebody else. And then if you do that, again, ultimately, it's the antithesis of a quid pro quo. It's basically figuring out if I knew somebody who would be great on your podcast, I would go out of my way to introduce you because I think you do a great podcast and I think they'd be a good guest. Period. I don't even need to be involved in any capacity. But it's a mutually beneficial introduction. And I think that more and more people need to do that. I think this generation right now, there's a lot of problems. First of all, the phone is going to be the smoking of this generation, number one. Two, I think the work ethic in general is not near where it is from my generation. And three, they want to do things quick. And anything good, it just takes a while. It takes time. It takes patience. And when you're 22 years old, it's easy to say, it's hard to do. And, you know, so if I had to do, I was talking to David Rubenstein last on a podcast I did with him 2 weeks ago. And like, if you had a do over, what would you do differently? And he went to law. He became a lawyer first. He's like, I wouldn't have done that. I did this. I wouldn't have done that. We all have do overs. We would all do things differently, I think. But I think one of the major things that I get out when I listen to people is I hate going to conferences and listening to people talk about how great their track record is or how subtly telling you how wonderful they are. I've made a ton of mistakes in my life, and a lot of entrepreneurs and people have made a lot of mistakes. I'd rather talk about the mistakes that I made than the fact that I might have done well in a specific strategy or, you know, grown my business to a certain level. The biggest compliment I ever received at a conference, and I speak at a lot of these conferences all over the world, is that was really authentic. And I didn't take that as a compliment. I just, you know, took the thanks. But saying that you were authentic, I think that's really important. And I think that a lot of these people look up to people like a David Rubenstein. Like, authenticity is really, really important. And again, everybody started somewhere and everybody could help somebody in some way. And you have to pay it forward. And I just think if that's a mindset you have, people see through it. And authenticity is really important also because you have to be genuine in what you're doing. And people see through that too. So I just think that, again, the family offices that I've worked with in general, a lot of these people, some of the common threads they have, they're very authentic people, good or bad. It just they're real, they believe. And they also have a lot of gratitude, which is a huge component of my life.
Those are good questions. And I hesitate to ask them because not everybody's comfortable going into those, but you know, since you did bring them up, I guess I would even ask you, like, what would you do? What would you have done differently in your life? What was the one thing that you regret, if any?
A lot. I would have done a lot differently. I would have. There's a thing. My daughter was 8 years old at the time, and we have a thing in our house where if you call three times, it's an emergency. So I was meeting with a large family office. I got three calls. I'm like, I got to take this. I thought she was in the hospital. I didn't know what had happened. I said, what happened? She said, Daddy, what are the five most important things in life? I'm like, what's wrong? She's like, no, I need to know this for a project. So I'm like, okay, well, this isn't an emergency. And we'll talk about that when I get home. So fast forward 6 hours, I went home and I said, first of all, only call three times if it's an emergency. Second of all, tell me what you're doing and I'll help you with it. And she, for her project, they had to do the five most important things for them. So for her, I worked with her on it. It was being popular. She's 8 years old. She wanted to be a really good athlete. She wanted to be a really good listener. And there were a couple other things. And then she says, as children do, what are your five? I'm like, yeah, whatever. Don't worry about it. But then it did resonate with me, and I thought about it. And then over the next couple months, I did think about it more. And for me, in order, it's love, gratitude, attitude, balance, and laughter. Those five, which isn't right or wrong. That's just kind of one of the most important things to me. And I only did that exercise because my daughter asked me to do it. But those are the most important things to me. So I think that I try to look at every person you meet, try to look at how's that meeting going to be impacted 10 years from now, not 10 weeks from now or 10 days from now. I think you've got to take a look. I think you need to be true to yourself. I think you have to slow down from the fast pace. I think surrounding yourself around really good people is, I've done a good job of that, but it's more important to me now. I try not to hang around people who are negative. I try to hang around people who are positive, who are caring and thoughtful. So the types of people I hang around, I wasn't as focused on that when I was younger. There's a lot that I would do differently. But again, like David Rubin said, I ended up in a fine place, but I wouldn't do anything differently per se because I wouldn't have learned those lessons, right? So it was like Benjamin Button. Like if I had do over, if I said, okay, I'm not going to do A, B, and C, it wouldn't be as relevant to me today to realize the mistakes that I made. So sometimes mistakes and errors that you make are your biggest lessons that you could learn.
Very smart. And I would ask also one last little bit of wisdom from you for people that have had a liquidity event and are sitting at home and listening, and they're trying to figure out what's the next action they should take. So for somebody that does come into a significant amount of money, where do they go? What do they do? What are the first things they should have top of mind so that they don't screw it up, basically?
Two things. One, the very first thing to do for everybody is talk to an estate planning attorney. What most people do is they see a great private equity deal, a cannabis deal, a real estate deal. Don't invest. Talk to an estate planning attorney. And two, don't do anything for 6 months or a year. And yeah, you might miss out on a huge opportunity. And I've never bought a stock at the bottom. I've never sold a stock at the top. And you're going to miss out. For 6 months to 12 months, just don't make major investments. Let things settle. And then over time, then start doing it. So talk to an estate planning attorney and do nothing for a year. That's my advice.
Very good advice. Okay. Before we wrap up, any other things that we wanted to go into that you wanted to bring up, that we didn't go into? Any questions that I should have asked you that I didn't remember to ask
No,
you
I think you were.
or know to ask you?
No, I think you. I think you were very thorough. You're very good at what you do. I just think that, when people want to talk to me a lot of times, it's because I'm this family office expert. But it's just, and people will often ask, like, how do you get to work with family office? It doesn't happen overnight. And it's not like, I get calls all the time, like, can you introduce me to this family? And it's just because they want to raise money for a fund. You have to take a much longer term perspective. And I think that for people who are looking to get into the family office space more, figure out a way you could benefit the family office. So when I'm working, even if it's a multi-billion dollar family, the first thing I'll do is I'll introduce them, because even though they're connected, they don't know everybody. They don't even know most people. I'll introduce them to other family offices so they could kind of share best practice. I'm not even involved in the conversation. But by introducing them to other families, that's a value add. Figure out ways that you could add value to anybody and everybody in whose life you're in, and I think in general, good things happen.
Very good. Okay. Last question that I ask everyone. Well, first of all, I'll ask you, where should people go to connect with you? Social media, website, all of that.
I don't the only social media I use is LinkedIn. So
Okay.
I'm fairly accessible on LinkedIn. I don't use Facebook or anything like that. I do have a I'm launch I just launched a family office podcast, so familyofficeworldpodcast.com. I just did one with David Rubenstein recently, and I
Amazing.
actually love doing that because I get to, again, surround myself with people that are smarter and more successful than me. So I enjoy doing that.
Great. Okay, perfect. I'll link those. So we'll get those links in the show notes. And then last question I ask everybody, after your career, after all you've accomplished, what does success mean to you?
It's a great question. I think being true to yourself, being authentic. I asked David Rubenstein the same question, and I'm like, is it more important to be happy or significant? I think that to me, it's being true to yourself, it's being authentic, it is giving back in whatever way you can. And at the end of the day, if enlightenment is ultimately what people want to do, I'm not there yet, but you want to, there's a lot more to life than just making money and creating alpha. I know a lot of miserable billionaires. If there were a direct correlation between wealth and success or happiness, I would just tell people to make as much money as you can. It's not the case. And it's the people who are thoughtful and think about how they want to live their life. So to me, it's a balanced life. It's a life filled with love, and it's a life surrounded by family and close friends that you can trust implicitly.
I know a lot of entrepreneurs listen to this show, and NetSuite has been a huge supporter for entrepreneurs, for business owners, because there's one thing that we all know. Business is about making money, and it's about your bottom line. And the less you spend on the nuts and bolts of running your business, the more profits you keep. But these days, everything is costing more. Supplies, people, shipping. It squeezes your margins, and I've been there, juggling multiple systems for finance, inventory, you name it. Each with its own costs and its own set of headaches. That's why I made the switch to NetSuite by Oracle. It's changed our company. Think about it. NetSuite is one of the top financial systems out there. It puts your whole business on one platform, accounting, finance, the works. One data source for everyone. There's no more mismatched info. And because it's in the cloud, it slashes your IT costs. No more servers, no more updates. Just access NetSuite from anywhere. With one integrated suite, your overhead drops big time. And here's the real win. Efficiency. Everything's connected in NetSuite. Costs are ridiculous lately. Find a proven way to reduce your expenses and get better performance out of your team. It's a no-brainer, and that's what NetSuite offers. Over 37,000 companies have figured this out already. You have to join them. Right now, through to April 15th, NetSuite's got an incredible, flexible financing plan. Check it out and see the savings yourself at netsuite.com/ScottClary. That's netsuite.com/ScottClary. Just a quick question. Have you ever had one of those oh no moments when you realize that you accidentally deleted a huge file? Or worse, your whole computer dies. I know I have. It's happened to me a lot, but don't sweat it. The sponsor of today's episode, Backblaze, they have your back. It is unlimited backups for all your Macs, your PCs, or even your whole company. And it's really affordable, under $100 a year. If you're running a business, they take the stress out of protecting everyone's data. If you need more bells and whistles for compliance, so on and so forth, they have enterprise options too. Honestly, losing data sucks, but Backblaze makes getting it back easy. They have restored billions of files. They offer tons of restore options, including rapid recovery in an event of data loss or ransomware. And you can access your backed up data from everywhere and anywhere in the world using their web app, iOS, or Android apps. It's been recommended by the New York Times, Inc., Macworld, PC World, LifeWire, Wired, Tom's Guide, 9to5 Mac, and tons more. And best, you can try it fully featured with no risk at backblaze.com/story. They set up that link for all Success Story podcast listeners. That is a no-risk free trial at backblaze.com/story. Seriously, back up your stuff. I don't know about you, but the idea of being harassed, scammed, or even worse, all because somebody found my personal information online, that's terrifying. Our political opinions, our addresses, even stuff about our families, it's out there for anyone to grab. And did you know that data brokers are allowed to sell information on over 98% of Americans? It's scary stuff. That's why I've partnered with Delete Me. I personally use Delete Me. They're a big friend of the podcast because I put myself out there online. So safety is a huge concern. It's really scary how easy it is to find someone's details and information, but Delete Me creates a layer of protection that we all need. You tell Delete Me what you want gone, and they make it disappear from those sketchy data broker sites. And Delete Me doesn't stop. They constantly monitor the web to keep your information off those lists. It's like having a privacy watchdog that never sleeps. You need to take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me. They're giving a special discount for all Success Story podcast listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/success and use promo code success at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/success and enter code success at checkout. joindeleteme.com/success.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, I just want to take a second and thank the sponsor of today's episode, Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond Bourbon. Now, I don't have a lot of liquor sponsors on this show. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is actually one of my favorites. I've drank it for a few years now, and this is why we actually decided to work together. Heaven Hill Distillery, family owned since 1935, is a great entrepreneur story too. So there's five brothers. They filled their first whiskey barrels back in 1935, and their legacy still lives on today. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond is aged over 7 years. That's three more than required by the Bottled and Bond Act of 1897. This means the best quality, the best purity, and the best consistency. This is not just average bourbon. It's the winner of the double gold medals at multiple 2023 World Spirits competitions, and they've won the very prestigious Triple Still Award. It's a very big deal in the liquor and bourbon world. Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond boasts an exceptionally smooth oak flavor, while its aroma offers a sweet blend of caramel and smooth vanilla. If you love bourbon, you need to try Heaven Hill Bottled and Bond. Available nationally, look for a bottle at your local store. Heaven Hill reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.